Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we celebrate good news in the food world, from record-setting butter sculptures to the latest discoveries in crop cultivation.
I think it was back in 2015. It was 2,370 pounds, and it was a Paris landscape. And so that became the Guinness World Record butter sculpture.
We don't understand everything about the world. So plant breeding also lets us work with all the unknown, maybe discovered along the way.
And we hear from the beloved chef and disaster relief organizer, Jose Andres.
Well, World Central Kitchen, we're an organization that we like to be the first ones on the ground. And more often than not, we are the last ones on the ground.
Tune in to Meat and Three, Heritage Radio Network's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Good morning. This is the Main Course OG. I am Emily Pearson, and today is... Oh, you shouldn't have. You shouldn't have.
I haven't been here in a while. Yeah, I forgot which button does what. So
thank you,
ready.
Mr. Mike Edison. Today is Thursday, October 17th, and I'm here with Mike Edison. Welcome back in the studio. And my other co-host, Patrick Martins.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure.
We found out this is episode 401.
Matt, is it true? Is Patrick full of shit?
It's true. The main course has had many iterations, but if you add them all
yes.
This is 401.
No, he's not full of shit. 401, awesome. Episode 400 was actually an on-the-road episode. We taped a live recording of our show at the Carolina Meat Conference, and that is up in the podcast store. And then this is 401.
I mean, I was really thinking about how great my first show was, the first show ever to be on the network. And I really, really think everyone should listen to it.
We can re-air it.
In some way, all the shows fall under that umbrella of, you know, considering food as a serious discipline, gastronomy to be a serious discipline that has multifacets like anthropology, sociology, global warming, you know, economy, you know, paying people minimum wage. It's all under gastronomy. You know, it's not just a fashion. And wow, we're 13,000 episodes in under that.
Well, it's 10 years.
I remember those early shows.
We've never had a critique show.
And basically used to beg me to come on, talk about anything. We've got 3 hours we've got to fill.
4 or 5 hours we went.
Mostly talking about professional wrestling and the Academy Awards.
And I'll say, Mike is a fucking pro. He came in and he gave and he goes all out and gives his best and goes hours every day.
Thank you.
It's nice to be with the pro.
Oh my gosh. So
Mike, easy one.
At what point did you guys reduce the shows to only being 45 minutes to an hour?
Well, the ratings were very high for my four-hour show.
especially the fourth hour.
My mother opened a lot of accounts. Yeah, the fourth hour, I think, was the strongest in many ways.
I think we should, in honor of the 10-year anniversary, we should replay and air your first episode.
It was so earnest. It was really, really, and I'm sure no one's listened to it. You know, we had no listeners at the time. But
all right, well, we'll make it.
Right. 401 is a big number.
I think that the fourth hour is what inspired Liz Warren to run for president. She said, we need some control. Someone's got to be in charge around here.
Anyone who's a registered Democrat who thinks Elizabeth Warren is not the best, brightest, smartest, most coherent, most able to have that job, if they don't think that, they're crazy. They may not want to say it because I don't think she can win, whatever it is, but she's obviously the one. I mean, she's head over heels above everybody. Come on.
If you disagree with Patrick, you can follow him on Instagram.
She's who you want to cheer for. If you don't believe me.
I've been rooting for her for a long time, long before she announced her candidacy.
Mike said he was concerned about her age, but her...
I agree, they're too old. I don't think it's ageism to think that we need a younger person. We need younger leadership. We need people who are closer to the...
Emily, you're not old enough.
I consider to be the future of the country. People who grew up with the internet. You know, I think Hillary Clinton 35. Is too old. I think was too old. I think Joe Biden is too old. I think Bernie Sanders is a great guy. He's too old. They're just not in touch with the youth of today, which is the future. Which is the future of the country. We need younger leadership. Right. I think all of these people deserve to be in public service. I think they're all great public servants. They're all very smart people. They have something to say. They should all have jobs or cabinet positions. But I think the president of the United States, I thought Barack Obama was the perfect age.
You thought he was old.
You call him Barack, not Barack.
Barack. I don't know what his wife. What does his wife call him?
I don't know. I always thought it was Barack.
Michelle, who's exactly my age, and President Obama, is that better? Sure. Is just a year or so older than I am. But I mean, he's like sort of like in that place. He's not a baby boomer. Enough baby boomers. Okay, enough already. We have to move on. We need a generation that is closer to having grown up and into the internet and knows how people communicate. Also, he had a family in the White House of you know intelligent young people who. You know, had their ears
that's
to the
true.
Ground.
It is nice to have children in the White House.
Because
you can run and then
defer for a year. Maybe you'll get elected and you're like, I won't make any decisions until I'm 35.
I just turned 32.
Yeah. So then the next year you'll be 33.
Oh, I see,
defer a year.
Defer a year. Okay.
So Dennis maybe could rule in your place.
In absentia.
No,
yeah,
but I think
exactly.
Having kids in the White House or kids who are high school age or going, you know, exactly.
It's tough on the kids. It was tough on what's her
connected.
Name? Clinton.
Chelsea.
Yeah, that was tough on her.
Oh, yeah. It was really brutal on her. She got like, what, a $600,000 job to do like 1 5-minute spot in NBC before she got fired? Yeah, it was brutal on her.
What about Bill Clinton's brother, like the drinking, shooting guns out of the back of his truck brother from Arkansas?
Or Jimmy Carter's brother.
I saw Monica Lewinsky on TV yesterday. She looks great. I don't know. I thought she was just like, I only think of her in the blue dress.
Let's not go down that path.
Okay. You got it.
She has an interesting TED Talk, actually.
Does she?
It's pretty good.
I have to check it out.
Surprising.
She was on TV about cyberbullying and PSAs that they're putting out. Mike, you had a book party this
Isn't
week?
Melania Trump against cyberbullying? That was her main cause. Perhaps. It was.
She and Monica can get together.
We did have a book party this week.
What's the name of the book?
My new book. It's called Sympathy for the Drummer, Why Charlie Watts Matters. It's about the Rolling Stones drummer, Charlie Watts. It is the first book ever written about Charlie Watts, and it's about the beat. It's about the big beat. It's about that crazy big beat. It's about why the Rolling Stones swing and why the right drummer is not replaceable. We had a great party the other night with my band, the Lucille Balls.
Cool.
And Patrick was there.
Mm-hmm. It was nice.
Did you get in on the jam sesh?
It was the best event I went to that night. Mm.
But yeah, we're really excited about it. And by the way, the Fleshtones, the guys from the Fleshtones who really are the stars of the Lucille Balls are playing tonight at Bowery Electric. So if you're tuned in and turned on, go see them tonight, the Fleshtones. The longest, best, greatest American running rock and roll band.
I loved Lucille Ball herself. She was great. I can watch that show all the time.
Do you know how famous she was at the time when she had her kid on TV when little Ricky was born? Was the most watched TV program at the time. Hmm. She was the most recognized person in America. I mean, it was huge. It's hard to imagine, you know, now that kind of popularity. Of course, there were only like one TV station at the time.
Mm-hmm. What was she on? CBS, right?
She was a huge Desi Lu
production. When was Lucy
there
on?
There was I Love Lucy, and then there were a few other iterations of the show. There was the Lucy Show, and there was the one where she worked in a bank. There was only Jackie Gleason on it. But it's the original one, though, with I Love Lucy.
And it also included when they moved to the country. They lived in the country house for a while to try to drum up ratings. And Ethel and Fred moved with them.
That was supposed to drum up ratings?
Well, you know, Little House on the Prairie, they adopted kids. Yeah, because you're like, I know these five characters. I've been watching them for 5 years. So you're like, well, they adopted someone. Who's crazy?
But some people who just don't remember why we called the band the Lucille Balls. She was one of a group of women, Farrah Fawcett being one of the others, the estate of Marilyn Monroe, Liza Minnelli suing for her mom, Judy Garland, who were used in the original artwork of the record Some Girls, the Rolling Stones record Some Girls. And Lucille Ball was one of the people who sued to have, you know, their pictures taken off the record of this kind of collage that they had done, this die-cut collage. So we just decided to call the band the Lucille Balls, and it's great because there's no
shortage. You can't shortage. Get sued for that?
I cannot wait to be sued. I think it'll really put us over. In fact, I might
nice
write...
to know it's all about the music.
In fact, I might even write the cease and desist letter myself all and right. send it to myself. But there's no shortage of pictures of Lucy Ball that I can deface and make fun of. It's endless artwork.
She's
anyway,
awesome.
it was a one-shot deal for her, just for this party, cool. for sympathy for the drummer. So
congratulations on the book.
Thank
and,
you very much. And if you like rock and roll, if you like music, if you like the Rolling Stones, go get it.
This is not the book for you. Oh, yeah, I mean, it is the book
exactly,
for you.
Exactly, exactly. All right, we are going to jump into our weekly based and meet our in-studio guests. So we have a game of word association. We've selected a couple words slash terms for Natalie and asked that you respond in 15 seconds or less. So, oh my gosh.
Sorry. Wrong
button. Natalie Grindstaff is our guest today. Mike, no more.
I'm trying to find the Jeopardy button.
Oh, there it is. Thank you. Oh. Natalie no Grindstaff is the... Okay.
I have the Jeopardy button now. Okay, go ahead.
All right. Settle down, boys. Natalie Grindstaff is the director of beverage programs at Crafted Hospitality and oversees a diverse wine and cocktail program and coffee. We're going to talk about that later.
And beer.
For all Crafted Hospitality restaurants in New York and Los Angeles. Good morning, Natalie.
Good morning. Thrilled to be here.
Thanks for being with us. So your word association, champagne.
Okay, I wrote a mini haiku for this.
A mini haiku? All
right. Well, I mean, I guess every haiku is a mini, right?
Okay.
Sip electric joy every day for happiness, pure effervescence.
Wow.
You didn't just make that up.
Not on the spot.
It was her bedtime rhyme.
It's very good.
It was.
Patrick, do you have a haiku for me?
No.
Patrick, do you know how many syllables are in
haiku? Isn't that new candy from Japan? Haichu.
Haichu. All right, your next one is climate change.
Climate change, so while there's going to be some horrible storms going on, I'm probably going to be drinking some English sparkling wine, because now that it's warm enough in England to grow grapes successfully, they're making some kind of cool sparkling wine. There's an upside.
The lighter side of global warming.
Exactly.
As usual, England at the cutting edge of gastronomy.
There was an article in the Times this week, I think it was in yesterday's food section, about how climate change and the there's a lot of newer wines that are happening in places that they were not necessarily, certain grapes were not always grown.
And there's some places where it was formerly considered too cold, or the grapes didn't ripen all the time, and so you wouldn't necessarily think that they were great terroir, but now are considered even better terroir. So in some ways it's good, in a lot of ways it's been really bad. Global weirding,
like,
and everything going crazy.
I like that you said the word terroir. Your last word is tetoir.
So I just thought that it was a misspelling of terroir.
Never. Oh, my God. Patrick has fallen. Patrick, please tell us, what is tetoir?
What is tetoir?
It's the terroir of the tet. Terroir of the mind.
Oh.
Tetoir, and it's passed on from master to apprentice. It's the terroir of the craftsman, the carpenter, the wine picker, the beer maker. The cocktail maker, that is partially terroir, but tetoir is the worker.
I've never heard of this.
I think it was.
That's why
it was
I collapsed.
It was coined by Patrick Martin.
I've heard of marijuar for oysters.
I know, and yet not tetoir.
And it hasn't really caught on. It's kind of like fetch in Mean Girls. It's just not happening.
I have 700 followers on Instagram. I would be sure it would be viral.
Someone told
now.
Me that you can't say woke anymore. That's not.
Is
that's,
that
that's
cool?
Not
it's not cool. It's not like the young people are not saying it anymore.
Yeah, young people. How old is a young person?
Maybe if
actually?
Elizabeth Warren incorporates woke into her campaign,
no,
then
tetoir.
They're gonna really know. Yeah. Too old.
But I think tetoir is a cool term for you, especially in all the beverage world that you do.
For me, the specialness of beverage, of course, when we're talking about something like terroir, it is the specialness of place, right? Mm-hmm. It's about being in a certain place that you can't replicate. So the people of those kinds of things are exactly the same. It totally makes sense to me, because the people behind the wine, beer, mm-hmm. cocktail, liquor, whatever the case may be, coffee, is equally as important and totally relevant to the conversation. So.
Right. Right, but certain things, like, for instance, obviously, you grow
I thought
coffee
it was a
and,
typo. Boy, I don't have quite the following
certain places
that Beyonce
in the world
does.
Grow distinctive and special coffee. If you're in Hawaii or Jamaica, I don't know, where, or Brazil, wherever coffee comes from, you're not going to grow coffee in New Jersey. But you should be able to make vodka anywhere.
Right. It's not.
But but if you are making something that's a more specialized product, what you make the vodka from can make a difference, right?
So, you know, since Patrick, I know
you. Doesn't have quite the
You don't
push.
Have quite the following.
Elizabeth Warren.
Our good friend Jennifer Aniston does. Mm. She joined Instagram this week. She joined Instagram this week, and overnight, without ever having posted, she went from 200,000 followers to 7.5 million. If you had 7.5 million followers, what would be your first post to the world?
Phone home.
And by the way, how could she have had 200,000 followers to start if she wasn't on?
It is a tricky question.
Yeah, that's a good question. I'll have to fact check on that.
Maybe those were the number of hashtags.
Or like went or from no, in what one I day. Sorry. I think what happened is she joined, had 200,000, and then her first post. Got she it. Went to 7.5 million.
I see.
I know nothing about Jennifer Aniston. Is she like someone?
Her post, by the way, was her and the Friends cast in that replica Friends set. That's
oh,
here
you mean
in, New
in
York.
The fountain?
Oh, so basically, no, it was wanton commercialism and self promotion was her first Instagram post.
Yeah, well, you know what? Now the point is, if you had 7.5 million followers, what would you have
would
one
post,
first post that
I
you
would
want to
do,
share with
I
the
was
world?
Thinking about that actually. I think I would do Elizabeth, but independently of this, I would do like one of Elizabeth Warren, like one of Winona the Duke. One of like a fast food chicken, you know, I would come up with 10 political ads and then a couple of humor ones in there. So no one thought I'd be, you know, beating them on the head with issues, but
where would the Yankees come into this?
Well, do you know what this could do for Tetwar or for the Yankees? Yeah. 7.5 million followers. You can make moves. People should use their Instagram to make political statements.
Yes. People should use their platform appropriately.
I've always thought that people in position of celebrity should open their mouths. I always hate it when someone says, oh, you're an actor. You know, you shouldn't talk. The people on the Academy Awards, you know.
Shut up and dribble. They told to LeBron James.
Oh,
like,
my God.
Don't give your opinion.
Or like someone who like went to a Bruce Springsteen concert said, I paid to hear him sing his hits, not to hear him talk about Donald Trump. It's like, fuck that. Have you been listening to Bruce Springsteen or Bob Dylan or whomever else for the last 50 fucking years? It's what they're about.
Yeah.
You know, if you're not into it, don't go. You know, and I think why is, and honestly, the people that are on Fox News are somehow more qualified than you know, Bruce Springsteen or Patrick Martins or anyone to talk about politics, because clearly they're not.
So what would you do with your 7.5? What would your first post be?
My cat.
You? Yeah.
My kitten.
And
watch that 7.5 million go to 15 million like that, because he's really cute.
I don't know. I have a.
So you haven't thought about the
no.
question,
yeah,
Natalie?
I have. Jeez.
So I would like to think I would keep it real and just do exactly what I currently do, which is just
pictures of
my cute ass kid, like eating some food my husband made and me drinking a glass of champagne.
But are you okay with 7.5 million people seeing into your world like that?
No. I mean, I'm real weird about that. I turn off my social a lot from time to time, which is not a good...
Are you a private account?
I'm not a private account, but I just don't look at it for months at a time.
I don't want to be robbed of showing pictures of my kid. I don't care. Some guy in Russia is using his face graphics to make a Facebook ad. Who cares? I mean,
you
I can't
your
control
kid
it.
To turn into like a meme that goes viral?
No, but if Josie's like doing some sexual thing on posters throughout Russia, yes, I will regret my decision. But in the absence of that, I won't.
That's really good. Protect your 3-year-old daughter from like sexual abuse in Russia. No. Bravo!
No,
sir.
If they PDF her into a Photoshop thing, you know.
Maybe just a fantastic, beautifully Photoshop photo of myself. The whole world will know my face.
I think that's what I'm saying. You know, it's like, you know, you like everyone else does on Instagram. Just show your best life. This is what I'm doing.
I think everybody else edits
show your
their best
life.
Life.
I love that. Did you say that in your job interview at the Calicchio Empire? You're like, I live my best life.
Best life.
Well, I think you have a responsibility on social media to be entertaining. That if you put something up, and even if it's about yourself and it's your best life, or it's a pretty picture of you or your kitten or your kid, it's got to be something that somehow someone sees and says, "Oh, my life is better for that." Like, you know, half a second that I glimpsed at your image,
and it's going to make them come back.
The opposite of what actually happens on something like Instagram, because you look at it and you're like, oh, my life is not that cool. And then you realize that no one's life is actually that cool at all. Everyone that posts, everything they post is through like a lens, right?
So what do you call about the lasagna shots? Where does that fall into your thoughts on this? Everyone's taking the worst photo. If you look at the 50 worst Instagrams of all time, like 30 of them
are lasagna. Is it the aerial photo of the lasagna?
Yeah, you just can't
see
anything.
I mean, clearly lasagna is meant to be shot from the side.
You need to shoot it from the side. You need like the Del Posto 50, was it 100 layer?
It's all about the layers.
Exactly. Yeah. All right, so we talked about your first post to the world.
Oh, this is going
to
really unleash
Mike. What about the, no, I was going to talk about your last thing. if you had a, forget about a Last Supper, what would be your last drink?
Oh, last drink. I mean,
think
you're
about
gonna
the
hear
mortician.
Champagne from me a lot because I'd love to drink champagne.
I read the Champagne and Nebbiolo. Those are your
yeah,
two.
Yeah, Champagne and Nebbiolo. White Burgundy is really high up in there. So Chardonnay, for all the people out there, Chardonnay is fucking delicious.
Not
you just
a,
haven't
I'm not
had
a
good one.
Exactly.
Trust me.
I'm learning. I've been having Trust terrible me. Chardonnay. I don't like it.
Yeah, no, you. We'll have
I'll come
a drink,
drink with you.
And we'll have some Chardonnay and you'll love it.
I think the last drink should be a digestive.
So wait,
that's such a good answer. I wish I thought of that. Amaro forever.
I love Nebbiolo grapes. I lived in Piedmont for a while. Yes. I love it. And then my second favorite is Valtellina.
Valtellina, beautiful
this
wines.
This Sforzato, yeah. Which reminds me of the Nebbiolo.
Well, they dry it a little bit, so it has a little more richness and power. But if you, have you had wines from Arpepe?
No.
Ugh, delicious.
Really? Check similar?
Well, they make Valtellina, and the wines are so good, and the woman that makes them is, like, the cutest.
Now, say that producer's name one more time.
It's Arpepe, A-R-P-E-P-E.
Oh, totally would have thought it was R-P-P, just said more eloquently.
Just so, champagne, it can be any sparkling wine, right? Or do you only mean champagne?
So I only mean champagne from Champagne, the region in France. But I do love sparkling wine from other parts of the world. Pepe Reventos makes a fantastic sparkling wine in Penedès, just like 45 minutes outside of Barcelona. And his ancestors who actually brought sparkling wine production to Spain. And I'm very passionate about their wines. They're so good.
So what percentage is champagne of a wine list on average? And what percentage is it at your place?
It's a disproportionate amount for how much is ordered. To be truthful, like Psalms love champagne. Actually, I think it's like the younger drinking demographic is drinking more champagne. But it's always been something where people are like, oh, it's a birthday or an anniversary. We should drink champagne. But otherwise, they don't drink it. But Psalms love it. So we always tend to buy a lot of it, even though it doesn't sell quickly. But 10% maybe.
Hmm. Very interesting.
All right. So we have a favorite game on this show. And Brandon's not here today, so we can play it. It's Fuck, Marry, Kill. We are going to choose liquor, beer, or wine.
So
I got this so wrong. I said fuck, marry, kill, and I thought we were talking about people.
It can be.
And I was
we are very, we go this wide spectrum.
And
on
can
this
it
show.
Be the same person?
No, we're not playing about people. It is.
Mike, listen to her. She's going to give a good answer.
Okay. All right. Your choices
Natalie,
are
you go first.
Liquor, beer, wine.
So wine I would marry because I have to have wine for life. Beer, I would fuck because I need beer. You need beer at the end of a long day or like if you had too much wine or you're drinking Riesling in Germany all day, you need a beer.
Or breakfast.
Or for breakfast, totally. Great answer. It's always appropriate. And then I would have to kill liquor even mm-hmm. though I do love a very well-made cocktail and it would be hard to live without, but...
But it would be an insult for somebody, like if we came as special guests of yours and you were like, oh, I'm going to be working here. I'll take care of your table. I'll order for you. And you're like, what do you guys want to drink? We're like a cocktail. You would be like, oh, I didn't curate that as much. Or is that not true? And the gins you choose and the...
No, yeah. So there, I mean, we have our various properties leaders who oversee different aspects of the program. So one, our property downtown Temple Court has, we have a bar manager there. His name is Angus Winchester. That's his real name.
Wow. That's an impressive name.
It's a great name. And so he has a really fantastic background in spirits and his cocktail point of view, all of that. I leave it to him because he's an expert and he really does a fantastic job. But in beverage, it's very hard not to kind of even if you're maybe more of a wine person, to not care at all about spirits or beer because you end up overseeing those programs a lot. Mm-hmm. In smaller programs, there isn't always a cocktail person and a wine person. If you're the wine person, you're also the cocktail person.
Speaking of, you're also the coffee person.
And
yes.
Also the coffee person. Yeah, which, I mean, I love coffee, so it doesn't...
I should have incorporated this into this game. If we added it, Patrick, what would you pick? Liquor, beer, wine, coffee. I don't know. I guess you kill too, or fuck too.
I mean, yeah. I would definitely do liquor and coffee to be part of my life.
So you marry them?
Unfortunately, wine and wine. I don't know. Maybe I just can't afford the good wines that I love so much. I find myself drinking liquor more than wine, and at this age, the gin Gibson, as you know, every time I
is
go
that
out.
Also because you'd rather it. Have two and be done rather than. This long culture of sitting and drinking wine over time?
I think the tannins in red wines that I like end up slowing me down a little bit, whereas liquor, like a gin in and juice.
More so of an upper. Me.
Yeah, it's an upper. But I love Barolo Barbaresco.
Yeah.
I love
it's interesting to me as someone who's a food person that want. I mean, certainly spirits and beer can pair well with food, but wine is like, there's something about having like a really great steak and a really great glass of Nebbiolo together. It's magical.
And I think part of the trick of drinking wine, maybe if you're tired of drinking the same wine, first of all, I know good wine is expensive, but you can also find very good wine at a $20 price point. And if you can find a wine that's like $18 and you love it, you should buy a case of it. You know, if you find a wine that's affordable and you really dig it, and also for me, part of the trick of drinking wine across a long dinner is to change flavors. Maybe start with bubbles, move on to like a white burgundy, something, you know, white with some body, and then maybe like a lighter red and climb the ladder. So when my steak comes, you know, then I'm having like a big Syrah or
Barolo. I think we should go to dinner together.
Gotta climb same the ladder. Page. You know, keep it interesting every time.
Agreed.
Patrick looks lost and confused because I printed him a fake copy of today's outline. I seem to be missing a page, so we're going electronically instead.
So what's the next question?
So I was going to transition, speaking of transitioning your beverages, tasting menus and beverage pairings. Yay, nay. Patrick just wants to drink a Jim Gibson through the whole meal.
They are tasting menus. I 1,000% always ask the sum because you're already spending a lot to pick a bottle, or usually it's two.
But you don't want to change wines with each dish.
Way too much. I'm always behind, and I want to enjoy it. I can't register that many flavors and tastes, especially with those kind of wines. But I love a great wine. Or two great wines, like a white for the first few courses, red for the second. Love it.
I think I'm with Patrick on that. I fall behind as well, and I'll end up where I have like the last sip of my white, and then on my second red, I'm still finishing the first one, and then I'm not eating it. You know, I'm not enjoying it properly, or you lose sight of the
food. But if it's a tasting menu, you're not talking about a full pour for every glass of wine, right? I mean, you're not talking
still.
It's still, you know, a little too much for me.
That we agree that there are four glasses of wine in a bottle of wine.
Yes.
Right? Okay. And anybody tries to squeeze like six or eight out of a bottle of wine, I find that irresponsible.
I thought it's four and a half.
It's four and a little. It's not really
four
half.
And a thimble.
It's like four and
is
a
is that why you have all those
smidge.
Little bits of so, wine
but,
in your house?
But for a wine, for like, you know, a pairing menu, you're gonna, or you know, a tasting menu where you're really gonna have eight courses, 10 courses, obviously that is a lot of juice to be drinking.
Yeah.
So, you know, obviously you start with something light and you start with whatever the bubbles or the lighter white. You already can't be 16 ounces into drinking before you've even started the meal.
Well, the best thing to do is mix in, like, maybe you do a beer pairing for one of the courses.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe there's a cocktail that
goes
with
it. Yeah.
So, like, kind of thinking of multi-dimensionally.
I've never seen that. Do you do that?
We do.
Oh, well, that's interesting. Cocktails, beer, and wine.
Sure.
Then I would 1,000%
And
do
what
it.
If you finish with a digestif instead of a sweet wine?
Amaro.
I agree. Start with a martini or a Gibson as a cocktail, because that should be an aperitif. It should be a bracer and kind of open up.
I'm all about aperitivo drinking. Mm-hmm. I love it. Like
before and after, right?
Well, I pretty much will drink aperitivos whenever, but
are you an Aperol Spritz girl?
Yes, and I'm not going to hate on the Aperol Spritz, even though, you know, there was the recent article, but I do agree that there are some really like much cooler, more interesting products out there that are made locally that are really special. Forthave, mm-hmm. I love.
What is that?
They make Amaro, and they also make a product that's like a sort of like a Campari. It's called Red, but they do their production in Brooklyn, and super nice guys, and it's like in a warehouse that's super tiny.
Emily,
to go.
A nice red
what's
vermouth
the name
is
of
a
that
wonderful
category
thing.
At the Good Food Awards called like tinctures, and what is that? All those little
it's
not tinctures, but
it's not a bitters category.
You mean like artisanal bitters?
What is that called? It wasn't called bitters, but anyway, that whole world.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a fascinating world.
Like drinking vermouth, I love drinking vermouth. Like all by itself with like a little twist. It's so good.
Fantastic. What is vermouth made of again?
It's aromatized wine. So it's the base is wine, and then they add bark and spices and other flavors.
And no
to it.
Two are the same, I bet.
Correct.
Even from the same company.
Exactly.
Patrick thought it was made from baby vermouths.
Our good friend and your good friend, Jonah Miller from Huertas.
Yeah,
he makes vermouth in the basement at Huertas, and they have it on tap.
In Spain, they drink a lot of vermouth.
It's the greatest. I lived in Spain for a number of years, and you could go to the Old Man Vermouth Bar with these giant casks of vermouth that, you know, that was probably who knows where it was made. And if you brought in like a, you know, old glass Pepsi bottle,
and they put like a little olive in it.
You know, they'd fill it up for, you know, $1.75 and leave a liter of vermouth. Oh my God! And yes, with the little the banderilla, whatever they call the things. There's like the old lady there sitting at the corner. It's like a tiny piece of anchovy, a tiny piece of an olive, a tiny piece of a guindilla, which is a hot pepper. The same person's been doing it since like the Second World War. And
like a little pincho?
That's it, a little pincho. But it's barely anything. It's like the tiniest piece of anchovy and the tiniest piece of olive, the tiniest piece of hot pepper.
You know, so would that be your?
And that would be.
Would that be your last bite and last drink?
Oh man, the problem is they cost. You know, there's a, especially in Plaza Chueca, there's in Madrid, there's a wonderful old vermouth bar. The name escapes me, but it's been there for like, you know, 400,000 years, and it has been the same old lady doing these little you know things on the toothpick. But it's like they're only like 1 euro each.
Yeah.
You know, when I think it was like, you know, 100%
pesetas. That's the way to eat, right?
You know, and
that is.
And I always meet people there before we have dinner, and people in Spain, not being the most punctual people in the world, I'm like usually like 19 vermouths in before dinner even starts.
And 19 toothpicks.
Dinner starts
but
at like 1
like
in the morning.
But you're still like, you're not blackout yet, no, you know, because vermouth is like light.
No,
and
no, because they're small, they're cheap, and they come quick.
So to answer
and
that.
And that's also with a splash of seltzer, a little siphon as they call it there. Bad. So it's vermouth con siphon, and then that little
I did a little Google. The Good Food Awards category is elixirs.
Oh, elixirs. Oh.
Elixirs.
Yeah, I like that.
That sounds like it could be anything. I like that.
So, Natalie, you've spent time on both coasts and lived in the South. Patrick, Mike, and I are pretty much just New Yorkers with a little bit of Spain, I know, Mike, in the middle.
And New Jersey.
Patrick's lived in Italy.
New Jersey.
I'm on New York.
The Dirty Jers.
What is everyone's least favorite state or city for dining out?
For dining out. Not in. Out. You're not saying anything about the people.
Dining in? Does that change by where you live?
Well, once you leave New York, everything starts to suck.
No, that's not true anymore.
Not true.
That's why New York chefs can't find other sous chefs.
We always talk about so ascending true. Cities. Yeah. Everybody's leaving to go back to their roots, to go to Minneapolis, to go to Houston, to go to LA, to go to Pittsburgh and open cool
I
places.
I would say Wyoming.
The Just whole be- state?
Yeah, to eat out in, I think.
No, more specifically Cheyenne, right?
To eat out in, like Italy is a bad country to eat out in compared to France and stuff, because very few people go out to eat, so there's not so much of a restaurant culture. There's the Osteria culture, whereas in America, we have very, very millions of good restaurants in every state because we're going out 4 nights a week as a country, you know, whether it be Applebee's or McDonald's, we're going out. Very few people even know how to cook, so I just wonder, like, if there's certain states that don't ever have a Michelin rating.
Yeah, I don't want to call it casual dining because it's just a phrase that kind of appalls me. But you're right, the Osteria culture, not ristorante culture, which which is elevated, but to have a good meal at a reasonable price.
That exists
everywhere. You know, that's everywhere in Italy. I mean, on the highway, if you stop in Italy, you will get like a good lunch. It's
the rustic food is the best food.
You know, it's not Burger King. You know, you're going to do okay on that level. And of course, fine dining is really well too. But you know, Italy.
I'm going to argue New York, outside of New York City, is probably a terrible dining out state.
Really? Ooh.
Yikes. I might be upsetting some people.
Yeah, I feel like there's like.
Like, there's little sweet spots.
Like Hudson Valley. There's
the Hudson
definitely
Valley.
Some,
you can tell
some,
me
like,
that you love the Phoenicia Diner. You can tell me you love the Wegmans restaurant in Rochester. But all the other shit in between. New York is huge.
But population density does get you some good restaurants. That's why I said Wyoming. I don't think there's even enough people to support 10 high-end restaurants in their capital city.
I think I had a hard time with like a whole state because I feel like
I added
region,
city.
Region
but I think
of the
like,
country.
I'm gonna say Florida.
I was thinking more like suburbs because I'm from the burbs and there was like not that much good stuff.
You grew up
happening.
In Atlanta?
I grew up outside of Atlanta. I grew up in Snellville, Georgia.
Snellville.
Not to dog Snellville because it's my hometown. No problem. But I do not recall a whole lot of dining that wasn't like Chili's or Red Lobster or, you know, like the chains.
Right, that's the
and
problem. But there's,
that, it was mostly that.
But I'll bet if you knew where to go, or there's great Southern cooking down there. There's, you know, some fantastic
stuff. Buford Highway actually was where we went to eat.
A lot of those
places
close early. They are open limited hours. You know, there isn't that dining out. Everything's closed at 8:30.
Well, I think, are we just saying fine dining? Where's the best fine dining style?
We were open to
interpretation. Dining out. I mean, you could include coffee shops in that, but you know what dining out means.
I think that that's an interesting, like, where can you not get good coffee? Because that to me is always when we travel, that's like the first thing. Where are we going to get good coffee?
I like shitty coffee. I mean, I don't mind it if I'm in the middle of nowhere. I don't love to go to a 7-Eleven, but I can go to any coffee shop, any diner.
Will you drink Starbucks?
I avoid it. I prefer diner to Starbucks, but I appreciate Blue Bottle and all that, of course.
Are you about the strength and sort of origins of your coffee or the flavor palette that's made better by milk and sugar? I don't know.
So I drink my coffee black most of the time, but I will indulge in some heavy cream in my coffee if it's around. So I'm kind of like either end of the spectrum.
So you're the Dunkin' Donuts light and sweet.
Yes.
And a little bourbon.
No sugar.
A little bourbon.
Me neither. Yeah, never like, sugar.
Rum, cognac.
Sugar, come on. You're drinking a coffee. Ugh. You don't need a sugar.
All right. So if you have to choose one coffee, is there one? Like a brand? A shop?
You're going to say Blue Bottle.
Well, no, I actually, so we work in the restaurants with Irving Farm, and I love them. Okay. They're awesome people. I think they have a really good product. They're amazing at training, and we have had a great relationship with them, and I really like their coffee.
They're roasters, right?
On the stronger side, yeah.
And where do they get their bean from?
You know, they get them from all over. Yeah. But they have some relationships with growers, and they you know, do fair trade and all of that.
I know nothing of bean terroir, and I know I see Kenya, I see Brazil, but I don't know what's going on and why I'm saying either one. But I'm like, well, absolutely Kenyan.
Flavors associated with at the larger the country.
Cherry, yeah. Tobacco.
Exactly.
So what's robust, the full-body. Elite Gaia of the coffee world, or the Robert Mondavi of the 70s? I mean, are there 10 regions in the world that produce 9.8s or higher all the time?
No, I mean, I think that it really comes down to the growers, just like it would with something like wine.
But then does it also come down to the roasters? They can make something
better.
Yeah,
they have a lot of power.
So this is, well, it's interesting because it's just like anything else. Like when we were talking about, which we ended up not talking about terroir, but... terroir. When you talk about terroir, you can make good wine. You can make only good wine from great terroir, but you can never make great wine from only good terroir. So it's kind of the same thing with coffee. Like, if you're in the right place to make and grow great beans, sure, you could like roast them kind of wrong and it comes out only good. But if you don't have the right, you don't start with the right product, then you can't like roast it into being better.
I love the middleman. You know, Anne really taught me to love the affineur, you know, in their role because of how much the cheese changes under their, you know, in their caves. It really does change so much. And the roaster or the dry ager of meats, you know, those are real interesting people. They're not the beginning. They're not at the end. Mm-hmm. They kind of do something to a raw ingredient.
It's awesome. Think that Anne would agree if you start, though, with like, not good quality milk, what's the point?
Yes, of course.
That's true of anything. Garbage in, garbage out. Yeah, I mean, that's what you always say. You know, if I'm going to make a record, you got to make sure the sounds go down good. Because if you recording bad songs, you know, poorly recorded, it's not going to be a good record no matter what you do. Yeah.
Bad songs, you know? Poorly recorded. You know, that a Freudian slip?
I wonder, like, a chef would obviously say ingredients are so important, but with food, can you doctor it just enough to still make it yummy?
Tons
like,
of chefs believe they can. I mean, I would say 80%, 85% of chefs in the country are like, what? I would buy Smithfield. It's 80 cents cheaper. And your husband is one of this very... very small percentage of chefs. I mean, think about how many chefs they are everywhere in every kitchen, you know, and those who are like, I must buy the best ingredient for these 10 dishes I make. Maybe not everything 100% of the time, but who are aware that there's a qualitative difference. Yeah.
So speaking of, before we take a break, what percentage of what you eat and drink do you all consider to be excellent?
Ooh, great question.
I know, I like this one.
Yeah.
I would say like, it's a pretty high percent. I'm going to say like 88.
I think a pretty high percentage too. I eat to live. No. I don't eat to live. I live to eat.
Yeah. Exactly.
So wait, you're saying 85% of the things you put in your mouth are very, 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 very good? Okay.
I'd rather forego a meal or skip something and wait for later.
Like if someone's
eat.
Like, here's this glass of wine. And I'm like, I don't want that. I just won't drink it.
I think it's to a point, it's like, it's, you know, like life's too short to wear shoes that don't fit. I mean, you know.
A lot of times someone, your wife will make you a pasta that's not so good, but you eat it and it's okay. So I wouldn't put that in there, did I? Enjoy it, but I hear what you're saying. A bagel with cream cheese,
really,
Friedrich bagels is so delicious. Even though,
really gonna throw Ann under the bus like that, huh, Patrick?
No, she made you a so-so pasta.
All right, Josie. Well, Ann puts nuts in everything, so
oh, I
it'll
do
be
too.
Like
and Dennis
I'm pro
hates
that.
That.
I'm pro that.
She puts walnuts in pasta. I don't know. It doesn't make sense.
Sounds delicious.
Well, I know, but I think everybody here is pretty tuned in. So I think high 80s is the right number.
Yeah.
And that's also got to include even if you're eating like a Klondike bar or you know something that's kind of junk food.
Malamar.
Or if you love Malamars, but you chose that.
We also said, do you consider it excellent? So there is a time and place for everything. Sure. So if in that moment you consider McDonald's to be excellent for that day, for that moment.
Right, okay. It's my choice. It's not like it doesn't represent my entire, the palate of what I eat across a week.
There's room for street pizza for sure, right? And there's great street pizza and not so good street pizza, but like.
We were talking about this before the show.
But you guys are making the case that you seek out what's going to give you pleasure.
100%.
I'm like, I was thinking of that question, like, is it the best version of it? Like, if Lucali's is the top of pizza to me, then where does Roberta's fit? And it's so close, it's basically in the same category.
Oh, no, I was looking in the grand scheme of my day or my week or how I eat.
Right, but
I wouldn't put a shitty Ray's pizza in even though I loved it.
I don't
while
eat
I ate
bad
it.
Pizza. I live in New York City, and I pay a high premium for the privilege of living here and part of the covenant, okay? Okay? But that it exists is that I don't have to eat shitty pizza, okay?
Yeah.
That is built into the cost of my rent and
Little
my cost
Caesars.
Of living of living in New York City that I don't eat shitty pizza.
But if you're looking States. At Lucali versus Roberta's, it's like whatever. They're both
excellent.
So they're both in that 80%.
But
I eat Ray's all the time because I'm hungry
Ray's might not be so bad, hungry. Or there are a couple by the slice places that are okay. But how many times?
Sometimes I'm fat.
How many
Parton's.
Times have you walked into a pizza place, looked at that shit under the heat lamp, and turned around and walked the fuck out?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It happens to me all the time. Yeah. You know what I say? I don't eat tired pie.
Ooh.
Good.
I like that.
From one to ten, I give that humor a 3.14.
But I'll walk out of a fucking place if I see pizza that's been sitting there. I'm like, nah.
Like if you order something in a restaurant and you have a bite and you're like, I just won't. I don't like continue to eat it.
I would still eat it.
Would you?
Yes, unfortunately. You know, I grew up in the 70s when McDonald's was like a privilege. My mom loved the freedom to be in a city where at 10 at night she could go out and walk the streets with me and go to a McDonald's and eat a delicious burger.
But now at 10 at night, you can go eat it. Now at 10 at night, you can go eat at a lot of cool restaurants or fast casual, whatever you want to do.
I actually think the city was a later city. I think people stayed up later in
the
70s.
We were talking everything's about changed. This. The city
like,
is much
the
earlier.
Reservation has become earlier. Like people used to want to eat at 8. And now they want to eat at 7.
Yeah.
And also, who comes post-theater? The post-theater business was huge. You would start meal at 11 o'clock.
People
no
come
problem.
Before.
I was on Restaurant Row last Friday night, and things were quiet around, it was 10:30, 10:45.
We
went
Lupa
for dessert.
At empty, not sadly, by 10, in the old days, I feel when they first started, there had just been nonstop.
The whole city, the whole culture, it always kills me looking at these old ads from the Village Voice for the rock concerts and the clubs, and it'd be the Cramps, midnight. The opening band would be at midnight, and the show would be at 1 a.m. And it was considered normal.
Would Anne ever
go now
to
it's
a
like
midnight
8 o'clock.
Show? No,
if you get there by 8:05,
you've
missed the first song.
Friend,
yeah. I just got invited to a 10 o'clock birthday party on a Thursday, and my husband's like, no way.
Are you kidding?
He's like, I will be home already. There's no chance I'm going back out. And I was like,
What about holding a wedding in Kenya? Is that annoying?
If you can weave it into an additional vacation.
Or Cartagena.
All right. On that note, we are taking a quick break. We will be back in a few moments with more with Natalie Grindstaff.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world.
Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
Join Heritage Radio Network on Monday, November 11th for a raucous feast to toast a decade of food radio. Our 10th anniversary Bacchanal is a rare gathering of your favorite chefs, mixologists, storytellers, thought leaders, and culinary masterminds. We'll salute the inductees of the newly minted HRN Hall of Fame, who embody our mission to further equity, sustainability, and deliciousness. Explore the beautiful Palm House and Yellow Magnolia Cafe. Taste and imbibe to your heart's content, and bid on once-in-a-lifetime experiences and tasty gifts for any budget at our silent auction. Tickets available now at heritageradionetwork.org/gala.
All right, and we're back. This is the Main Course OG, broadcasting live on Heritage Radio Network from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. We are here in the studio with Natalie Grindstaff of Crafted Hospitality.
We just had our husband in, Chris McDade, a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, Chris McDade, who's the chef partner of Popina. Yeah, we had a lot of fun. You said you were listening to his episode.
He doesn't think he's very good at like these types of things, but I always enjoy it. Although, he's very, like you said, earnest, which yes. I think is such a good descriptor. And I think Chris is a very earnest person.
I mean, to be completely honest, he's a little bit more sparkling wine. You're a little bit more champagne, just in terms of radio quality.
Sparkling wine, not Prosecco. He is sparkling wine. I like that. Are you involved with the beverage program there? Speaking of.
0%.
Zero.
0%.
We all know you can control it like a puppet.
Are you behind the scenes?
Nope, not at all. He has a partner, James O'Brien, who is extremely talented, very smart, and has made, I think, an incredible program. And he deserves absolutely every accolade for it. We all know
you did the one list. No, just kidding. But I do say, I claim to Chris that I have a better anchovy for him. We're bringing in three pallets. I know.
He's very passionate. You know, he's always anchovy on the gram. So he's very passionate about anchovies.
And he has a delicious appetizer.
I just want to say, I don't really trust people who don't like anchovies.
That means you don't trust me. It's a good measure.
Yeah. It's a good measure. You don't like the chovies? That's what we call our son sometimes, little chovy.
Yeah.
You got to come around.
I'm trying. I can appreciate that there is like these Italian ones that Patrick's talking about from Sicily.
They're wonderful.
I can appreciate that I'm supposed to like it and that the quality is excellent. I have trouble with very fishy flavors.
Last night, we sent out for some pizza, and I realized there were no anchovies in the house. It was a moment of panic. I remember it was like torrential rain last night, and I walked into Key Food with this giant umbrella to get some anchovies because my experience would not be complete.
Do you not eat pizza without anchovies?
No, sure I do. But I needed this to complete my little circle of happiness. I had my very specific bottle of red wine, and I really wanted pizza and anchovies. I was drinking a Syrah from Pacific Northwest. That's my new favorite, $18 favorite.
Cool.
It's like big, it's robust, it feels a lot like autumn to me.
Yeah.
And what's really working for me right now. And I'm sure in a couple weeks I'll move on to something else. But right now, it's my favorite $18 bottle of wine.
This was a question I actually wanted to ask you, Natalie. What beverage or wine or champagne do you pair with pizza?
Oh, champagne.
Champagne.
Is always a good answer. But I do like Gamay with pizza a lot because it has just like light freshness, juiciness. Like I think in reds you want like juiciness with pizza. I was
going full heavy. Garlic, anchovies, hot peppers, and like a big, massive wine. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of just where I was last night.
I'm into that too. But there's some great regional Italian grapes like Ruche and like lighter reds that come from sort of Piemonte area where you can just... It's sort of like the gamay of...
Now I need pizza and wine.
And you can never go wrong with Chianti with pizza.
Sure, yeah, totally.
So who are your mentors? And is there one lesson you always carry with you?
Yeah, so I've had like a couple of different kind of mentors. Like for wine, my original sort of wine exposure to really fine wine was I worked at Gotham Bar and Grill, and I worked for a wine director, Eric Zillier, who I adore and is a wonderful person. And it's kind of old school Somm. So I learned a lot about like the classics and, you know, how to do really proper wine service and those types of things. I have a friend, actually, who our son's middle name, we named him after somebody who was like a special sort of more leadership mentor to me, Robin Vaughn. And Robin kind of taught me like how to be with people when you're
to refer to them as numbers.
Yeah, exactly. like break it all down. No, he was just like a very caring individual. So when I think about how I want to lead other people, I think about Robin.
So terroir and tetoir.
Yeah. Yeah,
right,
exactly.
There, those two people.
The people. So for like lessons that are the lesson that I think of, I always try to be generous in assumptions. So instead of thinking that the other person is probably trying to like do something negative, think that probably they're on my side.
Thank you for your charity. You're like, this guy is so terrible on radio. I hate him. You're like, maybe he's trying his best.
Well, you know, I try to do that. I'm not saying I always succeed, but.
I think that's a great lesson, especially in the hospitality industry. Yeah, not only for your employees, but when you're helping guests.
Well, if you keep
that
in mind when people like show up upset and the first thing you can think is like, I'm sorry, your table's late and they're pissed off.
Yeah.
But you're like, maybe they had a really shitty day and they need someone to take care of them. And genuinely, that will 99.9% of the time turn it around.
People like, you've really pissed me off. It's true. That's the way I should be too. I think of things more as a headache, you know, almost like the way John McEnroe would have seen, like, a tortured that something is not working. And, you know, I've done a good job of overcoming it, but, you know, I do revert back into it for moments or periods. Like, if it's, let's say God creates an annual system where all the livestock come out in the spring and are ready for slaughter in the fall. That period can be stressful. Turkeys, ducks,
basically, Patrick's
geese,
telling you he's going
sheep.
Into his stressful time of year.
Turkeys,
we should
ducks,
all
sheep, lamb.
Generous assumptions that he's stressed and yeah, go into yeah. it with that. So tell us about Crafted Hospitality and your role there.
Tommy sure. C. You call
yeah.
him Tommy C?
All the time. He loves that. No, Tom Colicchio is our chef and owner, and I love working for Tom. He is one of those chefs that believes in ingredients.
And in believes in speaking his mind. I mean, he's
huge.
Actively
he's
said
so political
pro-Democrat.
And 100%. And working for someone that I believe in their ideals is huge for me. And I've been with Crafted now for 5 years. And I love working for Tom. I think he's a great chef. I think he laid the groundwork for a lot of great chefs that exist today.
We just ate breakfast, the three of us, at one of his disciples' restaurant. Taiwanese food, Winsun Bakery,
yeah,
just Trigg. Opened across the street from Winsun.
Trigg and I worked at Craft together. He was the line cook and I was the wine director. And he became sous chef and he's done so many great things. We're very proud of Trigg.
And there was a sandwich name at Winsun Bakery that just changed, but it was called the James Tracy.
Yeah.
Who's now at the Pecora Becca. So yeah, he has an interesting tree for sure. We also sell it to Philadelphia.
Yeah, Fiore Fine Foods, Ed Crochet, he came out of Craft.
Yeah,
and,
Ed was the chef when I first started.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there's been so many good chefs that have worked alongside Tom. And I think he is, you know, it's hard to say someone's like a legend while they're still alive. But he is a legendary chef and I think has been very influential. So it's an honor to get to work for him.
His first gig was at Gramercy Tavern, right? Or that mm-hmm. might not have been his first gig. That was
he opened Gramercy with... he and Danny Meyer were partners.
Wow.
So we like share a back wall with them. And we have a lot of, you know, there's like some sort of like a DNA feel sometimes. I feel like we're like bizarro Gramercy in some ways, but we have a lot of similarities and a lot of differences. But
well, I think
Kraft was very,
that's your terroir right there.
Yeah, Kraft was very pioneering. I remember I ate at that place for the first time with Alice Waters and Dorothy Cann Hamilton. And you did end up spending $80, $50 more a person because you didn't quite know what you were doing. But you ordered from appetizers broken down, vegetables broken down, Brussels sprouts are done three different ways. Mm-hmm. It really broke down the menu and allowed you to choose which of six mushrooms you got. It was awesome.
Yeah.
It was so progressive. And now everyone kind of does that. So many people follow
this,
that.
Listening to Tom tell the story of how he came to the idea of Kraft was like, it was spring. They wanted to, he was like cooking lamb and he wanted to just have like lamb and a bowl of peas on the table. And he's like, why can't I do that? Why can't that be a restaurant? Like just the best lamb and like the best peas in season. And I just put it on the table and people share it like you would at home. And that was like revolutionary.
If someone else doesn't like peas, then they could get Brussels sprouts
yeah.
with that same lamb.
Yeah.
You really got to pick.
So Kraft
is like
very
having
much
five caviars and you could pick which egg you want,
yeah,
you
yeah.
know?
And we've been open now, Kraft has been open since 2001, so we're like a grand dame restaurant in New York because they don't last that long anymore.
Yeah, for sure. And yeah. how many, and you also have some restaurants in L.A.?
We do. We have Kraft in L.A. in Century City, And Craft LA is awesome. It's they're also talking to them is always so funny from New York because they're like the most positive. We're like, what are they putting in the water out there? Everyone's like in a good mood and like so sweet and kind.
And
so.
Yet they all have like some crazy road rage incident when they're 55 years old where they do something totally beyond the pale.
Well, so, I was going to say, what's next? Are you guys opening anything new?
I feel like Tom always has 100 projects in mind. He's one of those like busy brain people. So it's always like, oh, we should do this. We should do that. We should do this, which is one of the reasons it's exciting.
Are you making an appearance on Top Chef anytime soon?
No. I was intimidated enough to come on radio. I don't know about TV, but you know, who knows where the future might bring us. But
episode 401, you were here for an historic one. Yeah, Mike, you too. 401.
Nice round number.
What was 401 as a year? What happened? Constantinople
got 401?
Something happened in Constantinople, I think. Back in the year 401. Also, what's the 40th anniversary? What's the gift that's given?
Oh, I don't know. I'll have to Google it.
40 silver?
I have no idea.
Gold would be 50.
That sounds right.
Platinum 60. Anyway.
Just making it up as you go along, aren't you, Patrick?
401 is a big number.
It is. Oh, I don't know. Ruby.
Cool. You're 401.
Give Patrick some rubies. Natalie, thank you so much for being with us today. We obviously, you guys should all check out her beverage program at any of the crafted hospitality restaurants. And stick around. We will be back with you next week.
I wish we had talked a little bit about soft drinks, actually. I was trying to swing this towards soft drinks just a little bit.
You want
to
know if they support Coke or Pepsi?
Because it's a little overlooked, I found. I was in a restaurant recently, and they had, I think Boylan's soda is like outstanding. And I used to actually work for Beverage World magazine, which is soft drinks and beer, not spirits or wine. But we were always getting these new soda pops in, and people were always trying things and going to these shows, and people were trying different things. And when Boylan's came out, I thought their root beer was like, oh my God, it was like an epiphany.
It's super
good. And the red birch beer, it was like hopelessly complex. And I found a place that had Boylan's on tap, and you just like went, I was like, oh my God. It's like soda. I don't even like soda that much, but it was like being a kid in a candy store again. And I think soft drinks and mocktails are the overall thing we overlooked.
Sure. We didn't get to talk about natural wines.
Everything
at all.
Isn't, you know, anything you put in a cocktail is you're going to consume it. So using something like not great is not going to, and you're not going to end up with a great cocktail if you don't have great ingredients. We use Q sodas, by the way.
Leo the First was born in 401. Byzantine emperor, as you guys probably know. He died in 474.
That's pretty good for back then.
At least he made it 40 years. He got some rubies along the way.
Sadly, Dun Yi died, though, in 401, the prince of the Chinese state, Northern Liang.
I can't believe no one knew that off the top of their head.
I can't believe it. I can't believe it at all.
How quick we are to forget those two guys.
Exactly. All right. Thank you all for joining us on the Main Course OG. We will be back next week with a special Go-tober episode. Stick around for a taste of the past. The Main Course OG is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for
listening. Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.